Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in Los Angeles, and this is the show where every week we deal with mental health issues from my own perspective of a holistic approach, which means body, mind, and spirit, however you want to define that for yourself, the importance in finding balance in our lives, within us, so that we're listening to the messages that our body's giving us, our thoughts are giving us, the patterns and all that, and whatever essence we call a soul or spirit, the more imbalanced we are, the more those aspects of ourselves communicate with one another and keep us healthy and hopefully joyous. Tonight, I won't have a guest, so I'm reminding all of you that this is a live call-in show. And the toll-free number is 1-866-536-1100, 866-536-1100. And if you're local in the Phoenix area, it's 602-277-5369, 277-KFNX. It's impossible to be in this world today without being extremely aware of the violence that's going on everywhere. Not just the Middle East, not just in Africa, not just between India and Pakistan, but in our own country, in our own communities, whether it's shootings, whether it's kidnappings, whatever's going on, there's a tremendous amount of violence. Tonight's topic is going to be about the violence we inflict on ourselves, the ultimate violence, which is suicide. The reason I picked this was because there was a very interesting article in the LA Times last Friday, October 4th, and the heading is Suicide Lead Cause of International Death. Can you imagine? The lead cause. First paragraph of the article by Thomas Moore II. Humans have a remarkable capacity for committing violence against themselves and others, causing 1.6 million violent deaths a year. Half of those by suicide, according to an exhaustive World Health Organization study. Further, the article says, when we are personally confronted by violence, it profoundly disturbs and unsettles us. Yet violence has such a persistent presence in our society that we often ignore it. And that was a quote from WHO Director General Gro Harlem Brundtland. Suicide, further in the article, occurs most commonly among the elderly and is three times more likely among men than women, with one major exception, China, where the rate among suicide with women is tremendously higher. We're going to be talking, I'll be talking a little bit later on about, you know, what the myths are of suicide, but I want you to think for a moment. Personalize this for yourself. Was there ever a time in your life where the pain inside you was so intense, where there was such a sense of hopelessness, or anger, or just a tremendous amount of sadness that you actually considered that the only way to end that pain was to kill the body? Most of us, at some point in our lives, not saying everyone, but most of us at some point in our lives, thought about what it would be like not to be here anymore, to not have to deal with the day-to-day stresses or the pain that we have or the sense of loneliness, alienation, isolation. Sometimes the thoughts may have been there because we're so angry with mom or dad or a mate that it's kind of like a punishment or way of getting even. I'll show them, you know, I'll make them find me dead and I'll show them. So it's really a sense of anger. So rather than dealing with the pain or dealing with the anger, the mind gets into such a state of overwhelm that it feels like there's no other choice. There's a quote from a website that I found that says, suicide is not chosen. It happens when pain exceeds resources for coping with pain. I'll reread that. Suicide is not chosen. It happens when pain exceeds resources for coping with pain. So, again, think about times when you felt maybe those resources were just tapped out, or someone you know or loved or cared about, who you could feel that they were just feeling so hopeless that they didn't know what else to do. And maybe you didn't even know what to do to help them, but you knew something was going on. Maybe you know someone that's committed suicide. Maybe that you yourself have attempted it, obviously, if you're listening to me. It wasn't a successful thing, thank goodness. But think for a minute again of what your coping mechanisms are. What did you turn to that helped you get through those thoughts? How did you get past it? Who did you talk to? How did you reason through it? Was it just time that got you past it? Some of us all of a sudden, you know, we wake up the next morning having worked something through in our dreams and something's lighter. We all have a life urge, and as long as we're in our body and breathing, our life urge is stronger than our death urge. Obviously, when we die, our death urge is taken over. And many of us feel like there's this constant battle going on between that life urge and death urge throughout our lives. Another reason why I picked this topic tonight was because a client of mine called me last night and was a bit distraught. His brother, who is an active drug addict and alcoholic, and they really haven't had much contact for a while because it's always been chaos and painful and stuff, and his brother lives not in L.A., but somewhere far from here. He got a call that his brother was in a car accident and was near death in the hospital, and he might have to fly back to where the family is. And we talked for a while over the phone, and this wasn't totally unexpected, but the brother really did not want to do anything to clean up, you know, get into recovery, deal with the drugs and the alcohol and the emotions and the pain that they were numbing for him. And so was this an accident or was it a suicide? There, to me, there's active suicide and there's passive suicide. And I believe that people who are involved with self-destructive behavior, while they may not be putting a gun to their head, they may not be consciously saying, I'm going to kill myself and I'm going to take an overdose, or they're not jumping off a cliff or hanging themselves, they are, over time, giving in to the death urge, disconnecting from life, and allowing the destructive behaviors to take them, in a sense, passively. Driving while drunk, that's not an accident. That's possibly a homicide as well as a suicide. So think for a moment about the things that you do, the extreme risks that you might do, that you might be able to put into that classification of passive suicide attempt, surrendering to the pain, the desire to numb it, the sense of hopelessness, the passive aggressiveness of not getting help and living in the drama and chaos and knowing that those around you are concerned or in angst about it. Think about the things that you're doing that are passively committing suicide. Overeating, not taking care of yourself, not exercising, staying stuck in a lot of negative thinking and beliefs and behavior patterns that certainly are not going to get you into a place of achievement. That's passive suicide. Not being fully alive is choosing not to be fully alive. Not being fully alive is choosing the path of death. Now, some of us feel dead inside, and many of you may know people that when you are in their presence, it feels like death. They just are not engaged. They're disconnected. They're in a whole other realm, so to speak. Again, choosing that, choosing not to reach out, not to get help, is passive suicide. So this client's brother, I don't know what happened today because I haven't heard from him, so it might mean that he got on a plane already, but his intention was that he was probably going to hear that his brother died by the morning, and he would fly back to the family for the funeral. But again, this is something that's been building. How many of you are drug addicts or alcoholics and have known that you've had these close calls, have known that you've been under the influence and driving, have known that you've been under the influence and were operating machinery you shouldn't have been, or going places that were really dangerous because of that, or exposing other people to danger because you were not conscious? That's passive homicide also. These aren't accidents. So, as you hear me speaking, some of you may be angry with the things that I'm saying because it may be hitting too close to home. You may be relieved to actually hear me say some of the things I've said or will be saying before the end of the show tonight, because maybe somebody is reading you. So think again how this applies to you. Now, some statistics. This is from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. And this is statistics about suicide in the United States. More people die from suicide than from homicide in the United States. Males are at least 4 times more likely to die from suicide than are females. However, females are more likely to attempt suicide than are males, which means when males decide to do it, they do it. Nearly 60% of all suicides are committed with a firearm. I'll say that again. Nearly 60% of all suicides are committed with a firearm in the United States. People living in a household where a firearm is kept are almost 5 times more likely to die by suicide than people who live in gun-free homes. I know the NRA doesn't want to hear all this, but people living in a household where a firearm is kept are almost 5 times more likely to die by suicide than people who live in gun-free homes. And why do you think that is? Why? Because if someone has the thought or is choosing to do something and the impulse is there, the means are there much more easily. It takes more planning to hang oneself. It takes more planning to do an overdose. It takes more planning to do other things. A gun is much quicker. Firearms were the most common method of suicide used by both men and women. The most common method for men, 74% of men who committed suicide used a firearm, 31% of women. And another interesting thing, risk factors for suicide among older persons differ from those among the young. Older persons have a higher prevalence of alcohol abuse, depression, a greater use of highly lethal methods, and social isolation. That last one, social isolation. They also make fewer attempts for completed suicide and also have visited a healthcare provider before the suicide and have more physical illnesses. So think about all that while we take a break. We'll be back with Tell the Truth Faster in a few minutes, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler, and tonight's topic is suicide. The toll-free line, if you want to call in and ask a question or talk about what you might be struggling with around this or your own experience, 866-536-1100. 866-536-1100, locally in Phoenix, 277-KFNX. Now, before the break, I talked about the incidence of older people with suicide. Now, you have to think in terms, again, of the issue of isolation, loneliness, the end of their life, limited ability to get around for many of them, and illnesses that make it very difficult for them to go on and feeling very little support. We're going to go in a minute and talk about teenagers and young people, but I believe I have a caller. John, you're on the line?
Yes.
Hi, where are you calling from, John?
I'm calling from Phoenix.
How you doing?
Yeah, I have a friend that's he just got off his medication. He was taking Paxil for 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And he got cut off cold turkey, and he's having a really rough time. Is there any pointers I can give him, anything he can do? He's going through dizzy spells.
Mm-hmm.
He's just kind of dementia.
Yeah. Is when you say he was cut off cold turkey, was that the doctor deciding?
No, he ran out of his access.
Ah. And there's no clinic anywhere that he could go in. Because even if there's a doctor that's been prescribing it ongoing, the doctor's office really should make sure that there is a referral somewhere to make sure that, you know, he's not just cut off from a medication that really is important like that. So that's one thing I think needs to be dealt with.
I'm sorry.
No.
It was that his access ran out, and his medication cost $105 a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
So he can't afford it.
The Paxil cost that much?
Yes.
Wow. If I think you get the point that something like this somebody should wean off of it. So what you're seeing with him are withdrawal symptoms. Is he aware that what you described as somewhat dementia type behaviors and things like that? Is he aware that he's going through this, or is he out of it?
He's very depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Crying spells.
Uh-huh.
He's moody.
Yeah.
He gets real upset.
Has he talked about suicide himself?
No, nothing like that.
Okay.
But it's fear of going insane.
Okay. Yeah, it feels like that when you even heroin addicts or any kind of intensive drug that someone's been on, it feels like insanity when people are detoxing. And especially with something like an antidepressant, it took a long time for him to build up to the level that was probably helping him. My concern is, if this is going on, that you need to get him to an emergency room or call one of the recovery programs around Phoenix, like Sierra Tucson.
He's did everything possible.
He's done what?
Back to the access and the behavioral health.
Mm-hmm.
We cut him off. Didn't even know the crisis line. Had no idea what to do. They sent him down to the county facility on 24th Street in Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to give out emergency meds, some extras, you know.
Right.
But they're not allowed doing that no more. They have to be, evaluated?
How long has he been off the Paxil?
It's been a whole week now.
Just a week.
Yes.
These first couple of weeks are going to be the hardest, and that's why weaning is important. If you are feeling, I mean, you're a good friend to be just concerned about him. If you are feeling like the behaviors are getting destructive and getting dangerous emotionally, but also if the physical withdrawals are really looking like it's doing damage, get him in the car and take him to an emergency room and explain to them what's going on.
You know, the sad thing is he didn't want to be put on a medication, for one.
Yeah.
And he warned the doctor that, you know, they didn't want no side effects or anything crazy. They assured him everything would be okay. Then he got cut off all of a sudden.
Was it helping when he was on it?
Yes.
Right.
Very much so.
I'm not that familiar with what the social service system is in Phoenix, but that's why I'm suggesting calling the Meadows of Sierra Tucson and explain the situation. They should have a list of referrals or clinics or someplace that is open to people without funding that this can be done. But like I said, if this is getting dangerous or this is getting really difficult, it's something beyond your means to handle, and you need to get them to an emergency room and explain to the doctors what's been going on. They will know how to treat it.
Do you know if he just goes on and takes it, you know, like a you know, pretty much like a trooper and just deals with it, will it go away soon?
Will it pass? You know what? For most people, I would say yes, but it's just like any other withdrawal process. Without the proper supervision, it could get very dangerous for him as well as the people around him. And that's why I'm saying something like this should have been weaned, and if he's going through it like this, he really needs to be under supervision. So that's
yeah.
what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
Well, he's pretty upset. He's talking about suing and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is why I'm saying I don't blame him for being upset. I mean, to have something like that, it's like all of a sudden someone telling you, you know, if you're diabetic, you can't have your insulin anymore, especially if you're saying the Paxil really was helping balance out his brain chemistry and the depression wasn't there. But if it really was that he was on it, it was working, and all of a sudden they just took it away from him, you know, I don't know what the reasons they would have done that would be. So what I'm telling you is the more immediate issue is making sure he's safe in this process, and if that means getting him to an ER, do it. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, because you'll be glad you did also, because it's more than any layperson can handle. It's a lot for me to handle, and I've helped people through that.
Okay.
Okay, John?
Thanks.
Good luck. Okay?
But
okay. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back to talk tomorrow and tell the truth faster, so please stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshul. I want to thank John for calling in before the break and send some prayers out to his friend that he can get the help he needs, or at least get through this detox. The one thing I tell people, I have clients that have been on antidepressants or other meds to help balance up brain chemistry that were really helpful and for some reason decide on their own to stop taking it, and they don't understand that there's a problem there, just to cold turkey off it without supervision. And it's very important. So getting back to our topic tonight on suicide, of course, as you can imagine, the condition someone's mind might be in when they're going through withdrawal or a detox. There are times when people actually have attempted suicide because of the pain, the physical pain, and the insanity that it feels like when someone's going through a detox. That's why the supervision is so important. That's why inpatient detoxes is so important, or at least some kind of guidance and supervision by a medical doctor and a therapist, so that there's a place and people that you know you're trusting and will feel safer. In the case with John the caller, he obviously has a friend that he's a friend to this person that he can really, his friend's lucky to have him around to do this and to keep an eye on it. Now, suicide. Was mentioning earlier how older person, the prevalence among the elderly is so much higher, but persons under the age of 25 years accounted for 16.4% of all suicides in 1992. The incidence of suicide among adolescents and young adults nearly tripled from 1952 to 92. From 1980 to 1992, the rate of suicide among persons 15 to 19 increased by almost by over 28%, and persons aged 10 to 14 increased by 120%. Now remember, we're living in a society and in a country and in a world where young people are exposed to so much more pain and suffering, fear of abduction and violence and in the home as well as at school and being teased. We know that the rate of suicide among gay and lesbian teenagers is 10 times higher, anywhere from 4 to 10 times higher than the rate of suicide in teenagers in general, because of the sense of isolation and hopelessness. And it's very, very difficult, particularly for gay and lesbian teens, but just think what it's like just to be a teenager in general. And the angst a lot of us go through as our body chemistry is changing, as socializing things is so much more important. In 1992, this is still from the CDC, more teenagers and young adults died from suicide then died from cancer, heart disease, AIDS, birth defects, stroke, pneumonia, and influenza, and chronic lung disease combined. Now, also, ethnically, we have the issue that from 1980 to 1992, for African-American males aged 15 to 19, the rate of suicide increased 165%. Okay, so these are statistics. These are facts that are disturbing enough, okay? Like I said, we all have gone through pain. We all have gone through sad times, the loss of a loved one, a divorce, a separation, losing a job, health issues, drug or alcohol abuse or depression. Why is it that some of us are able to get through things like that and other people have such a greater sense of struggle through it and sense of hopelessness? Well, part of it may be body and brain chemistry. Part of it may be the fact, and remember it's very early on, I said suicide is not chosen. It happens when pain exceeds resources for coping with pain. Resources for coping with pain. What were we taught growing up in terms of dealing with our emotions, in terms of knowing how to communicate when we're hurting, knowing how to turn to other people, knowing how to have a sense of balance, whether it's exercise and eating right or going for walks in nature. Some of us were just taught natural skills for coping with things so that even when the pain levels increase, we have a repertoire of things to turn to help us cope with these things. Even if there are times that feel darker than others, we know we're going to get through them. So the other part of it is people who have more difficulty need to improve their resources for coping with pain, learn greater sense of skills. Now, how do you do that? Well, therapy clearly is one way to get around, to get through some stuff like that. A good therapist will really hear what you have to say, is not going to judge you. That you may feel like this, they're going to take you seriously and help you get past the desire to end your life and look at the things that are causing you so much pain and find out what tools you already have and help you learn to add to that repertoire of coping mechanisms. So therapy is important. Group support, whether it's group therapy or support groups like Suicide Anonymous and other things like that, if what you keep going through is this spiral, you know, there's a lot of different support groups at mental health centers, at churches and synagogues, mosques, all that sort of stuff, where you can turn. For some people, it's their spiritual crisis, so it's hard to turn to their organized religion or whatever. They're feeling too much shame, too much guilt, thinking God doesn't love them, and basically, it's about healing that belief also. What is it about ourselves that we're not loving? What is it about ourselves we have such judgment on? And where do those messages come from? And that isn't about getting into a blame fest about mom and dad and all this other stuff. It's about looking for solutions, knowing the source of some of it and what these messages are, and then dealing with the reality of those messages. And we talk about this on the show all the time, our beliefs, the thought processes we have, that create joy in our lives or create darkness in our lives, that support our life urge or support our death urge. It's important to be able to take a look at what your negative patterns are of thinking, of belief systems, all that stuff, so that you can really start pulling them apart and healing, forgiving, getting a different perspective on it, removing yourself from situations that keep creating more of the darkness and making it more difficult for you to survive. Knowing who's out there for you to turn to. So, again, if you're in recovery yourself and know someone who's in recovery, you know how difficult it was to finally acknowledge that. To finally say, I'm an addict or I'm an alcoholic or I'm a sex addict or, you know, I'm having anorexic problems. You know how difficult it was to take that first step and actually acknowledge the problem. The denial was a darker place that was so much more familiar. It's the same thing with this, that to be able to say, I'm hurting so much that not being here actually sounds more attractive than what life is like being here. To be able to admit that is the first step towards healing it. To be able to say it, not out loud, just to kind of wallow in it, but to actually go towards solution. To seek out a good therapist, the right group, the right organization. There are crisis lines. I'm going to talk about some of that later and give you some phone numbers before the end of the show. But it's so important that you find people that are sympathetic, non-judgmental, that have a sense of patience and calm, that they're accepting. They're not making you feel worse because you're feeling bad, if you get what I'm saying. That the people you're turning to are not people that are going to give you more material to keep piling on the stuff you already have going on in your head to say, I want out. So, I mean, of course, that's easier said than done, because what do we usually do when we want to do something? We go looking for proof that we're right. So if someone wants to kill themselves, they're going to look for proof to see nobody loves them, nobody's there for them, nobody understands them, and it's just not worth it. So we're going to take another break here. Stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes, and we're going to talk about solutions. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. Tonight's show, we've been talking about suicide. And a lot of people are afraid that if they start asking someone if they're suicidal, that it's actually going to encourage them or drive them further in that direction. Actually, the opposite is true. Asking someone directly about their suicidal intentions will often lower their anxiety level and act as a deterrent to suicidal behavior by encouraging their ventilation of pent-up emotions. And often as a therapist, I'll be very direct with someone, and they know what I'm doing. You know, I'm asking them if they're thinking about killing themselves. I'm asking them if they have a plan, how far along have the thoughts gone. And one thing that I do all the time when I get somebody who is talking to me about wanting to die or kill themselves is a contract. Not a suicide pact, actually, although it is a sort. It's actually, and often I'll do this in writing, that if they are getting to the point where they are actively planning on it or beginning to get close to that, that before they do anything, they will call me, and they will not do anything until they've actually spoken to me directly. That doesn't mean that they got my answering machine and they left the message and said goodbye, that the agreement is that they will wait until I get back to them or that we actually have a conversation. Basically, what we're doing with that is, first of all, if someone's willing to agree to that, they're looking for help. And most people actually have honored that pact. I've actually had come up with an agreement with someone that I know they wanted to die, they wanted to kill themselves, but would they wait 24 hours? And they've agreed to wait 24 hours. And sometimes that amount of time helped them get through the acute pain, but also gave us time to maybe look at other options like hospitalization or medication or finding out really what was going on and getting some communication flowing. So the non-suicide agreement is very important. Now, some of you may know, because I've mentioned this a number of times on the show in the last year, one of the things I do is I actually do counseling at 3 gay bathhouses here in Los Angeles, where they actually pay me a consultant fee, and I sit there, and sometimes people come in to talk to me, sometimes they don't. But I had a guy at one of the bathhouses today, a 23-year-old Asian Pacific guy who was asking me why he's willing to let guys have intercourse, anal intercourse with him without a condom. And we talked about this, and part of it is his neediness to have someone just take charge and not wanting to lose somebody that's finding him attractive and desiring him, and all these the self-esteem things that actually we talked about last week on the show, all the insecurities, all the fears that are there, that he knows that most of the time he'll use a condom, but he will let people have anal intercourse with him without a condom. And we talked about this being that active / passive suicide type of thing, you know, the risk he's taking that he knows he's taking. And he tested HIV negative just 3 months ago, but there's still that issue, that dynamic, that we will do things based on our self-esteem issues, based on what we feel our needs are, sense of security, sense of support that we feel we'll lose if we don't allow somebody to do something to us or we don't do something ourselves, that actually is rather destructive and dangerous, but we're going to do it anyway. This is, again, not a conscious, I'm going to try and kill myself, but the risks involved in things like that lead up to the potential for one's life changing considerably with illness and medications and doctors, where life becomes about that, which a lot of my friends and clients that have had AIDS over the years have had lives like that, not all of them, but it makes a major difference. And, you know, he got it. He really got it. So let's assume that somebody that you care about may be suicidal. The first thing is take them seriously. Even if you're uncomfortable with it, you'd rather pretend like you're not really getting it so that you don't have to deal with it yourself. Take a look at how you're willing to close your eyes and ears to somebody that you love. Take them seriously. Okay? Remember, suicidal behavior is a cry for help, especially if, obviously, they're telling you about it. So they're saying they want to talk about it. Listen to them. Remember earlier I said, you know, non-judgmental compassion. Don't tell them they're crazy. Be willing to give and get help sooner than later. Suicide prevention center or whatever, help them get there. Listen. Okay? Give the person every opportunity to unburden their troubles and ventilate their feelings. And like I said, ask them, are they feeling suicidal? Let them talk about that. If they're acutely suicidal, don't leave them alone. Urge professional help. And that's important. Most of you listening are not professionals in this field. Know your limits. Know your limits. Know when to pick up a phone, even if it seems to anger the person that you're with. We're going to come back with closing with some of those thoughts about that after this final break. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Pastor. Tonight I've been talking about suicide, and I want to end with a couple of important statements. Not that the rest of the show hasn't been important. One of the things is no secrets. Very often someone will say, I'm going to tell you this, this is what I'm going through, but please don't tell anyone. Okay? Even our professional ethics as therapists say there are three reasons that we break confidentiality. Number one, if someone is acutely homicidal or we feel that they are serious about wanting to kill somebody and have a plan. Number two, suicidal. Number three, if there's child abuse going on or elder abuse, we have to report those things. If someone's coming to me for help, the first thing that I realize that I need to realize is their lives are at stake. And even as a therapist, I cannot do all of it alone, and I will not take onto my shoulders that this is going on and I've agreed to keep their secret. Because what happens if they achieve it? And I need to know when it's time for me to turn for the extra help by picking up the phone. Letting their family know or their whatever services are around that I'm helping them get there, even if I take them in the car myself to an ER, to a mental health center, okay? So know that, especially as a layperson, you're not violating their privacy when they're telling you they're going to kill themselves or kill someone else, you need to know that's more than you can handle on your own. Okay? There are national suicide prevention lines, crisis lines. So if you yourself have no one you can turn to, there are people who will listen. 1-800-SUICIDE is one of them. If you look at the front page of your phone book, there's usually crisis lines, local crisis lines numbers listed there. To teenagers, there are places like Covenant House, the 9 line, 1-800-999-9999. So if you're a teenager, you know, having difficulty with that, there are people who will listen. It may be over the telephone. For a lot of people, that's less threatening. But it's important that you know your limitations as a person in pain and as a person who cares about someone who's in pain. That's not a weakness. I'm a therapist, and there are many times when I've been in therapy and I've needed to reach out for help, and I've needed to know when I can't do it all myself or I can't cope, and I need to know that there are people around me that will help or that there are professionals that I can turn to also when I need to, that I can practice what I teach. And it's very important. Your life is at stake, and life doesn't have to be the struggle. If you really learn better coping mechanisms, if you really start healing the things that are creating this kind of pain for you, life can be a joy. Life can be pleasurable. Life can be more passionate for you. There could be love in your life that really is consistent. And that is the goal of everything that we're doing. And I know that most people who are suicidal feel it's hopeless, it's never going to be like that for them. But you need to start somewhere. You need to start somewhere, and you're worth it. So pick up a phone and call and get some help for yourself or for a loved one. And if you're the one supporting that loved one, you need that. You need the support too. Don't kid yourself, all right? So hopefully tonight's talk helped somebody out there. And I'll be here next week, same time, same place. This is Stuart Altschul, and this is Tell the Truth Faster. Thanks for listening.